So pleased to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're going to start the program today by taking a look at some rural wit and wisdom with Jerry Apps, historian and author. If you listen to this program, you'll remember conversations I've had with him in the past. He's authored more than 40 books, and a lot of them deal with rural life. And that's certainly what we have in his latest book. It's called Living a Country Year, Wit and Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And as we talk with him, certainly if you have questions or remembrances or comments that you want to bring out, I hope you will. Give us a call. Here's the number, 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Jerry Apps, welcome back.
Always good to be here, Larry.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in. I've read most of your books, many of your books on rural life. I think most, all of them probably. And what amazes me is your recollections. You do. And it's fun. It's fun for me because, as you know, I grew up on a farm, too. And so things that I hadn't thought about and probably wouldn't have thought about, I'm reminded of as I read your stories.
It's interesting. Lots of people have said to me, how in the world do you remember all of those things? And one of the things I do and have done for many, many years is to teach creative writing workshops. And my creating writing workshops have as a part of them some tips and techniques for tapping into our memories. And so I try to practice that myself in my own work. And as I travel around and as I see rural buildings and I talk with rural people and I hear their stories, very often that triggers one of my own stories. And I say, aha, I remember something like that. And I'll sit down and write it. And that's happened again and again. And I've been doing that for 35 years. These stories have kept popping up. I thought after the first half dozen or so, that'd be it. But I've published now more than 100 of these stories. Unbelievable. And I haven't gotten through high school yet.
No, and this book, it's a month by month.
Yes, it is. And what I tried to do was to take each of the months, obviously, and try and recall a story that fit that month as I remember it. And some of my most vivid memories, of course, go back to when I was a kid. That's true for many of us as we get older. And they are stories that relate to farm life during World War II, essentially, because that's when I was still a kid. And another reason I'm doing that is that there are a lot of people around who do not have a recollection, and they weren't around, to know what World War II was like on the farm. I'm as a historian, I'm very interested in helping to recall what ordinary folks went through during the war, and especially farm people. There's quite a bit of writing about what the war was about in urban areas, but it was quite different on the farm. And a number of the stories in here have that as their basis. What was it like on the farm during World War II in February, March, and April, and so on?
Mm-hmm. And of course, the stories revolve obviously around your life on the farm with Dad and Mom and Grandpa and Grandma. I think there was a story about Grandpa early on in the book.
Yes.
In February, maybe it was. I don't recall exactly.
It was February because that's the year that on my mother's side, the family was Witt, W-I-T-T. So I'm fondly, or sometimes less than fondly, known as a half-wit. But that's another story. Grandpa Witt was quite a progressive farmer in our neighborhood at a time when almost none of us had electricity. None of us had indoor plumbing. We all milked cows by hand, farmed with horses, all of that sort of thing. But Grandpa Witt had a Delco electric plant. Those who remember those, and there are a bunch of people around who do, the pump house was half filled with big glass batteries. And the generator was powered by a gasoline engine. And it charged up these batteries. It was a 32-volt system, but it allowed for some light bulbs, and it allowed my grandmother to have, can you imagine this? And it was really important in those days to have this particular piece of technology, an electric iron. She did not have to depend on the old sat irons that sat on the wood stove. And in the month of July and August, to see my mother ironing with sweat pouring off of her because you had to have the cook stove tuned up to get the sat irons warm enough for ironing. My grandmother had an electric iron.
And a washing machine that worked.
Well, she did. She had a washing machine that had a little electric motor, and our washing machine had a Briggs and Stratton engine. They could not get that thing started. It is at that time when I begin to learn some of the rich profanity that comes from one who is frustrated. My dad trying to get this Speed Queen washing machine with the Briggs and Stratton engine going.
You know, as I was thinking about this, there are most people anybody who was born, you know, after 1950 or so, would have, you know, would almost, I think, stare in amazement or read in amazement at what went on back then. And you tell a nice story, I think is in the forward of your book or the early on, about a family that came to you as when you were doing a book reading. And I think it sort of gets that point across.
Yeah, that was one of those instances where I was absolutely without words, and that doesn't happen very often. I was at a book signing, and those who have been to book signings know that you sit and listen to an author talk for a while and try to stay awake. And then after the author runs out of steam, you're supposed to line up and purchase a book, which he will then sign. And I was at one of these events, and there was a good crowd. There were a whole bunch of people there. And a woman came through the line, and she said, "I don't want to talk with you now. You have lots of people behind me. But if you just, I have something I want to tell you when you finish." Now, what that usually means to an author that you've either found a misspelled word, which happens all too often, or you got a comma in the wrong place, or they want to start an argument over something that you said. So I'm thinking, oh my gosh, it's going to be one of those nights, and. So I'm signing books, and finally we get to the end, and she has a couple of kids with her, little boys, and I braced myself, and she said, she started out by saying how much she appreciated my books, and that sort of floored me, because that's not what I was expecting. But then she went on to say that what she and her husband had been doing, they lived here in Madison, what she and her husband did almost every weekend is that they would take their boys out to one of the Dane County parks, and this is unbelievable. They would read to their sons from my book, and then from one of my books, and then they would ask their kids, "What do you think that means?" Hmm. Now that's precisely what I'm trying to do with my work, to help people understand that there was more than good old days and some kind of nostalgic sense going on. But there was something far deeper ingrained in rural life here in the Midwest especially, but all over the country as well. There were beliefs and values that were a part of growing up during the Depression, during World War II, growing up on a farm, beliefs and values that were integral to what life was like, and they wanted their sons to have some sense of what that was all about. It involved work, it involved neighbors, community, having fun, working hard, all of those kinds of things.
Well, that would have brought a tear to my eye if any.
Well, it what it did to me, it did that. But I just sort of sat there sort of dumbfounded, like, didn't you find a misspelled word?
Oh, boy. Jerry Aft's our guest today. We're talking about his most recent book, Living a Country Year, Wit and Wisdom from the Good Old Days. And it's published by Voyager Press. I'm really pleased to have him with us. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. Vivian in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Vivian. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I would like to recommend another book, Following Through the Years in Wisconsin, because I believe that history is not these, you know, the presidents and the wars and the kings and the it's we little people. And the title of the book is A Nostalgic Almanac. And the author is Edna Hong, H-O-N-G. And this was published in 1980 by the Augsburg Printing House.
Mm-hmm.
And Edna was born in 1913 and just passed away a couple of months ago. And through what it's like growing up in Taylor County in Wisconsin and doing it month by month. So you're talking about the years and the values, and she has many funny things. I want to give you just very quickly two little funny things. And also you're talking about the values of modernity. She has some comments on that. One is, this is in her January, some have called central heating a long step toward the freedom of the individual. Others have labeled it a blow at the American home, one of the initial forces in the scattering and shattering of the family.
What do you think of that, Jerry?
Well, I know the book. I've read it, and I know the author. And she has done some excellent work. That's a very fine book.
So it's a nostalgic... Oh, let's see. What was the title of it?
Nostalgic Year, I think.
A Nostalgic...
Edna Hong.
Edna Hong, H-O-N-G. Vivian, thanks. Thanks for sharing that with us. Appreciate it very much. Well, you have, as a matter of fact, you have stories in your book, month by month, and then at the end of each chapter, you have some sayings or thoughts or words of wisdom of your own that you've collected from others or your own thoughts.
I've had lots of fun with these. One of the things that I've done over the years is to collect one-liners from rural people, and some I simply make up out of old cloth. For instance, just a couple. Try reading a book by candlelight, as Abraham Lincoln did when he was a child. It helps one remember that greatness has little to do with convenience. And then don't, some are a little cynical. Mm-hmm. Don't believe two-thirds of what you hear and say nothing about the rest. And then sometimes it's important to just breathe deeply. And finally, if bigger is better, why is a dime worth more than a nickel?
Okay. Jerry Apps, our guest today, author of Living a Country Year, Wit and Wisdom from the Good Old Days. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking rural wit and wisdom today with Jerry Apps, Madison historian and author of many books, including Living a Country Year, Wit and Wisdom from the Good Old Days. If you want to join in with your own remembrances, questions, or comments, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions and comments. You know, as you said, Jerry, while I'm thinking of it, things weren't always peachy keen on the farm, and there were a lot of problems. And I believe it was May when you write about an unhappy story in a way, but there's also some good outcome from it.
Yeah, that was the time that I had polio, and I hadn't written about that for ever. I had polio when I was 12 years old, and I was bound determined that no one would ever know about that. It was obvious in school because I couldn't participate in any sports. I couldn't run. I could barely walk by the time I got to high school. But in later years, I've said, what the hey, that's part of who I am. The fact that I am limping around today, it's because of what happened when I was 12. There was a lot more to it than that. When you're 12 years old and you can't do what other kids are doing, especially when you live on a farm where you're expected to help with the farm work, you feel about as low as an earthworm crawling under a manure pile. I mean, mm-hmm. you can't feel much lower than that. And the disease, and this happened in 1946, when there were a lot of kids in Wisconsin, all over the country, suffering from polio. And I was my leg was essentially paralyzed until April. And my dad finally he said to me that he knew how I was feeling sorry for myself. He said, "You know, we've got a lot of work to do. We had a tractor then. We had a Farmall H tractor, the kind with the front wheels together in the front, the tricycle mm-hmm. kind. And to drive it, the clutch was on the left side, and there were two brake pedals on the right. And in order to turn to the left, you not only turned the steering wheel, but you had to push the brake pedal in order to stop the left wheel some to allow the tractor to turn. That was especially the case in soft ground, if you were disking or dragging or doing any work like that. And my dad said to me one morning, he said, "Jerry, enough of this feeling sorry for yourself. There's work to be done." He said, I want you to help disc the cornfield." And I said, "Well, I can't move my leg." He said, "Well, I'll carry you." He did. Carried me up, put me on the tractor seat. And I said, "What am I supposed to do when I get to the end of the field? I can't move my leg." He said, "Well, you do the best you can." And I was so angry with him. I mean, I thought this was the most miserable thing a father could ever do for a son, to force him, the kid, to do something that he knew he couldn't do. And so I'm on the tractor, and there's a disc behind me, and I'm trucking across the field, and I come to the end of the field, and there's a wire fence, and I try to turn, and of course I can't handle the brake pedal, and the tractor runs into the fence, and the fence posts are flying, and the barbed wire fences fly, pieces of fence are flying in the air. I get the tractor stopped, and my dad comes running. I thought I was going to really catch it, because tearing up a fence is a major offense on the farm, no matter if the cow does it or whatever happens. But he didn't. The first thing he said was, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And, well, of course I'm okay. I'm just smashed up the fence. So he said, "That's okay." So that was the first time I knew that there's something else was going on here. He turned the tractor around for me, and he said, "No, go the other way." Well, what happened, within 2 weeks, and I was doing that every day, within 2 weeks I was able to push the brake pedal enough in order to make the turns. And by the end of the summer, I was off of crutches and able to walk. That's an amazing story, I think. Back now at my dad, who knew exactly what he was doing in forcing me to do that.
And today, your dad might be reported for
cruelty to kids. I mean, we didn't have a hospital with any kind of a physical therapy. I had no physical therapy, whatever. I don't think we ever heard there was such a thing. You took care of it yourself. And that I am forever thankful that he did that.
Phil in Minocqua, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Phil. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think I met Jerry one time. I actually think maybe my wife, Annika, might have done some illustration for him at one time, but that's been some time ago. I had a story about, if I could share it with you,
sure.
About outhouses. I think Jerry had had a chapter in one of his books or something about that. And if you have a moment, this fellow's name was Curly, and his daddy was a very staunch, disciplined-type German fellow. And with some great pride one time, he'd put a glass doorknob on the outhouse. And the outhouse, of course, opened out, as they all did. And his dad had left strict instructions. These boys inherited some little .22 rifles with shorts, and they were planking things that you're not supposed to. And he left instructions, "You boys, don't you ever, ever shoot that glass doorknob." Well, that's just like giving them a challenge. And one cold winter day, why, Curly had gone out there, and he planked that with his .22, knocked that glass doorknob off the outhouse. And then revenge is sweet, so to speak. So he'd had a urge to go to the bathroom very badly a little later, and he developed a case of a little diarrhea. and went out there to open the outhouse. Well, it started sleeting, and it sleeted the door shut. So Curly goes around in desperation to the back of the outhouse and pulled his bibs down, leans up against the back of the outhouse, and does his number. And of course, being in the condition he was in, he got some inside his overshoes. And when he went back to the house, his dad was not exactly sympathetic. One of those wonderful stories you can remember. I want to share that with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Phil. Though the outhouse stories are, I have a head full of them, obviously. One really quick one, which is not in this book, but the hired man, it's a hired man story. I've got a couple of hired man stories in the book. But the hired man is headed toward the outhouse in a hurry, and he fails to note that the clothesline is just a little lower than he anticipated it would be. And he's hustling toward the outhouse with other things on his mind than this clothesline. And his boss's wife is hanging up clothes at the time. And the clothesline catches him right under the chin, and he goes flying up in the air and lands in a heap on the ground. And the the farmer's wife says, "Are you okay?" And the only thing he could say was, "Yes, but I couldn't have made it anyway."
Oh my goodness!
We had a fellow, Jerry, that a classmate of mine. He turned out to be a pilot for Eastern Airlines, but we had an old boy in town that did not like children, especially boys our age. And every Halloween, the temptation was to upset his outhouse because he had a fine one. So they'd slip down there a couple nights ahead of time and done some preliminary work, and then slipped down there with the intention of upsetting that outhouse, knowing Zeke would be watching. Got out there, and it was pretty dark, and they managed to get the thing going over, but you know, you would stick a piece of wood in there or a nail, good nail, through the back of the outhouse and then clench it. And they'd have what toilet paper you had in those days. We were pretty modern. We didn't get away from the Sears and Roebuck catalogs. And as they tipped it over, why, that clenched nail got under Lee's class ring, and he went up with the outhouse, and then he got so far up with him, the nail swung around and dropped him in the pit. Well, again, some of the best laid plans, you know, just don't work out.
Oh, my goodness. Phil, thanks. Thanks for calling. And Phil's wife?
Illustrated a couple of my children's books a few years ago. Stormy and Eat Rutabagas. That's the name of the two little children's picture books.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Well, I tell you what, I want to mention before I forget about it, you've got some upcoming appearances, and we want to certainly talk about those. You're at Barnes & Noble on Thursday, June 14th at 6:30. That's Barnes & Noble
in Racine.
And then you're at the Chilton Public Library in Chilton on June 20th at 6 p.m. Oshkosh Public Museum in Oshkosh, Saturday, June 23rd from 10:30 to 1:30. That's hosted by Apple Blossom Books. And if people want to get some more information on that, just go to jerryapps.com, I would guess.
Yes, I have a complete calendar of things all through the summer on my website. And Larry, I even have a blog now where I have some recipes from this book on my blog. So if you go to my website, jerryapps.com, you can get more than you ever could imagine.
Okay. Blah, isn't it amazing the changes in technology?
It's a truth. When I couldn't even spell blog a few years ago.
My wife's putting a blog together on our home remodeling escapades, MuellerFamilyLife.blogspot.com, and it's amazing how many people are reading that that website.
Yeah, I always thought it meant blog down, but that's slightly different than that. So.
Oh, my goodness. Again, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Well, this is the month of June, of course, and in June of one year was you had a real highlight as a youngster that you write about in your book, and it's a great story, and it has to do with a pony.
Yes, our pony's name was Ginger, and I'd written about Ginger before because it's sort of a a sweet and bitter story, because it started when one June evening, we were sitting on the back porch, and the local trucker, the livestock trucker, who every week went around the neighborhood picking up calves and what have you to haul to the stockyards in Milwaukee. And I was wondering why in the world he was coming in the evening. And the reason he was coming in the evening, he had in the back of his truck a Shetland pony that my dad had purchased for my brothers and me. It had been a circus pony and somehow had been injured. I don't know what my dad paid for him, but it wasn't very much. And it was just a wonderful little pony who was tame could be. And we did all kinds of things with that pony. My brothers, who are younger than I, figured out quickly, especially my brother Daryl, who lives in New Jersey now, figured out quickly that for brother Daryl to get rid of him, in other words, if they didn't want Ginger didn't want Daryl on his back, he would just very, and he did this, I would say, politely. He walked under a low-hanging branch of an apple tree and just scrubbed my brother off. And my brother would run after him, angry as could be. My other brother, Donald, the twins, he thought that Ginger ought to be able to do the work of a horse, and so he hitched Ginger to kind of a makeshift binder twine harness that we'd put together to a walking cultivator, and we had a kind of a sand pit where we kids played. And my brother Donald decided he was going to cultivate that sand pit with Ginger. Of course, the poor little horse couldn't, poor little pony couldn't pull it. Well, the story goes on, and it was just a fun time that summer. But then that fall, in fact, Ginger was like our farm dog.
They ran around together.
Yeah, they were big buddies. This is another area of interest of mine, and I need to explore it more. The communication patterns of animals one with another. I have hints of that in a number of my stories, but especially between farm dogs and cattle or with sheep, there's just a tremendous communication that's going on that we're not aware of. In this case, it was the team. Can you imagine this? A team of a collie dog and a Shetland pony. They would go after the cows together, that pair. Yeah. And then in very often in the barnyard, they would sneak into the barnyard among the cows, and it'd be almost like the cows were, they'd smell them, and like they're talking. They'd say, how are things going today, Ginger, and all that kind of stuff. So people would drive by and say, your pony is out. Did you know that your pony was out on the road? And my dad would say, well, yeah, the pony goes wherever he wants.
Wherever he wants.
And he did.
Nancy in Grafton, let's go to you. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Well, the first thing I just remembered, today is my birthday, and when I was a little girl, maybe about 8 years old, my dad told me, Nancy, go out and get the cows. Well, I went out to the east pasture, and I think my dad knew our horse was going to foal, and I came running back so fast because our horse had a little colt out there, and I was the first one to see it, and it was my birthday. And that was a long, long time ago, but it just came to my mind right now as you were talking about horses.
And that's such a wonderful memory.
Yeah, and another thing is my husband's dad would buy horses out west and bring them home, and he had a tavern 4 miles south of Edgar. Well, they'd train these horses, break them, and then so one day, my husband and his brother, Ray, who was a little bit younger, they were about, maybe 15 and 10 or something like that, going into Edgar with this team of horses with a wagon. Well, the horses decided to have a runaway, and they were down in the ditch, and the evener went off, and, it was a mess. The lines were all tangled, and there they were in the ditch with these horses, and along came our priests, and we had Father Oscar and Arthur Kramer. They were twins. And they're coming down in their big car, and they see these young kids in the ditch with the horses all tangled up, and they go and they make the sign of the cross. And my husband's brother Ray says, "You damn fool, that's not going to help. Do something." And they kept on going, you know.
Oh.
Horses, too. When we were little kids, We lived in the middle of a 160-acre farm. Well, you didn't have bus service, you know, and the roads didn't get plowed because we were in the section, and so it took a long time before the roads got cleared off. And so my dad would take the stone boat, which he cleaned the barn in the afternoon with, and he would hook up the horses on the stone boat, put all new straw and horse blankets, and we would go to school 2 miles over the snowbanks in the stone boat, and we thought we were just really, this was the best thing that could have happened. We couldn't have got there otherwise, you know, but Dad took us out with the horses on the stone boat.
You were about 2-3 notches ahead of most of us either skied or just plain walked to school. I skied to school for a long time over the top of the snowdrifts. So riding on the old stone boat, that indeed must have been an adventure.
And it didn't even smell.
At least you didn't notice.
Not so that you'd notice. Nancy, thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Appreciate the call. And Jerry and Beloit, we'll go to you now. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Hey, I got a story about outhouses. When we was kids up on Turtle Creek and here in Beloit during the war, we used to dump over the outhouses. We had a neighbor, German neighbor down the road that was a bear's butt, and we couldn't tip his outhouse over, so we moved it over about 4 or 5 feet. And he went out there in the middle of the night, and he fell in. And he come down and give my grandpa hell and everybody else hell about it. And we was always picking on him. I don't know why. He come out and went and washed himself off.
Boy, I tell you, you could probably do a whole book of outhouse stories.
In fact, if there's a common question that I get, and I get lots of advice on what I should write next, that one ranks right up near the top. When are you going to do a book on outhouses? And I say, well, probably never.
Jerry,
not
thanks.
Not that I don't have a lot of stories.
Jerry, thanks. Madeline and Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Madeline.
I'm calling about a book that I've read that maybe you have also read. It's about a boy that had polio, Behind Enemy Lines, a memoir by John Durand.
Oh.
Now, that one I don't know.
All right. He's from Wisconsin. He grew up in Spooner, and when he was in first grade, he developed polio. And it tells all the problems that his family had, yet it was from a large family. I happened to see an article in the Eau Claire paper. It was about Dave Wood had written, he used to write for the Minneapolis Tribune about books, and he had been a roommate of John Durand in Eau Claire, and I also went to Eau Claire at the same time, the university in Eau Claire. And so I looked in my yearbook and saw pictures of him. He was a great debater and president of many organizations and so on, but it's a very good book. The only problem is I couldn't get it at Borders, and I looked it up, and he finally, I guess, decided he couldn't get anybody to publish it for him, so he has his own publishing company, and that's puzzleboxpress.com, mm-hmm. and that's in southern Wisconsin somewhere.
Okay.
And I think you'd really be interested in reading it, or everyone I've given it to read just finds it, you know, very fascinating.
Yeah, thank you for that, because there are a bunch of us who had polio who didn't talk about it. It would be similar to people who've served in World War II and didn't talk about that. But there comes a time when we do start talking about it, and realizing that when we have something that's as critical in our lives as polio, and knowing that it had killed a bunch of people, to look at that time, that was really a turning point for me, because I could not do many of the things that other young people were doing. So what did I do? I read books, and I studied, and I started writing stories. And I started doing, interestingly enough, I started announcing basketball games, because the coach felt sorry for me and said, well, Jerry, maybe you can sit behind a microphone. And I'm 14 years old announcing basketball games, and that was my first experience with a microphone. And that's many, many years ago, and I thank that coach so very much, because I've done a lot of work with radio and television ever since.
Yeah, absolutely. Madeline, thank you very much for calling. I hope you'll take a look at Jerry's new book, Living a Country Life, Wit and Wisdom from the good old days. Appreciate your call very much. Clyde in Wauwatosa, we'll give you a chance here. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. I was born in a farm in central Illinois, and I was about 5 or 6 years old. And my dad just purchased a Model T Ford, and he didn't know too much about driving it. And so he wanted to show it off, so a bunch of people there. So he got in the Model T Ford, and he started driving. And he was driving around the barnyard, and he couldn't stop it. And so we just kept yelling at him and laughing and everything. And I can't even remember how he finally stopped it, but I can remember that as a very unique experience.
That's a great story. And in my book, Living a Country Year, I have a Model T story. One of our hired men had a Model T Ford, and he asked me one time when I was just 10 years old, and he said, "Jerry, how would you like to drive my Model T?" And I'm driving this Model T Ford around our alfalfa pasture, around and around. There are three pedals on the floor, for those of you old enough to know about Model Ts. And I'd figured out which was low and which was reverse and which was the brake, and that was my first experience driving.
Oh, great. Thanks, Clyde. Thanks very much for calling. Well, we've only touched the surface here of the stories, and you also have some recipes in there. Why did you add recipes this time, by the way?
I just thought it would be fun. I have my grandmother's and my mother's recipe boxes, and my wife, Ruth, who is a home economist, has been using those recipes for years. And I thought that would be just kind of fun to pick out a recipe that fits the month, like chili, homemade chili for January. And we have a strawberry pie recipe for June. And we have a leaf lettuce a recipe for May and so on.
Well, they're all a lot of fun, and it's a pleasure to read your books, all of them, and this one I enjoyed very much as well. Thank you so much for coming by and talking about it.
I'm glad to do it. And anyone wants to learn more, just look at jerryapps.com, jerryapps.com.
And just remember, in June, the month of June, Jerry will be at Barnes & Noble on the 14th in Racine. He'll be in Chilton at the Public Library on the 20th and at the Oshkosh Public Museum on June 23rd. And he's got other things going on throughout the year. Go to his website, and you will find out more about Jerry and his books. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you very much for having me, Larry.
Jerry Apps, Madison historian and writer, professor emeritus at the UW-Madison, author of more than 40 books, including the one we've been talking about, Living a Country Year, Wit and Wisdom from the Good Old Days, published by Voyager Press. Certainly any of your local bookstores, you'll be no problem getting copies of the book. If they don't have them right in stock, they certainly can order them and get them very quickly to you. Pleasure to have him with us. I always look forward to Jerry's visits, that's for sure. Well, coming up, we're going to be talking with you about the 18th Annual Renewable Energy and Sustainable Living Fair. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.